I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And today is the deadline imposed by federal judge Dana Sabra of the Southern District of California to finish reuniting the roughly 2,500 children, ages 5 to 17, who were separated from their parents at the border under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. The government has faced an enormous challenge in its efforts to reunite these families. But Kirstjen Nielsen, the Department of Homeland Security secretary, told Fox News' Brett Baer that she was satisfied with the government's efforts.
Well, we're on track to do it. We're working hand in glove with HHS, and it's certainly our intention to reunify all families that are suitable.
Despite the government's optimistic outlook, they have deemed a significant number of parents ineligible for reunification, and hundreds of parents were reportedly deported ahead of their children. Joining me now is Caitlin Dickerson, an immigration reporter with the New York Times, and she's got the latest developments. Thanks for being with us, Caitlin.
Thanks for having me.
So today's the deadline. I think there's not much of a surprise that many of these kids have not been reunited with their families. Tell us where we stand right now.
So today we expect to see about 1,600 children finally reunified with their families. And those are the kids who have been deemed eligible after background checks and confirmation that people who claim to be their parents actually are, and also confirmation that the parents are still in the United States. But like you pointed out, that leaves almost 1,000 children still in federal custody for a number of reasons. And there's still a lot of work ahead, especially when it comes to those parents who were deported without their children. And the government doesn't know where those parents are right now.
So there's a lot of mess, it sounds, already. I want to go back to this idea of eligibility. Now, these were families who were separated at the border by the Trump administration. And now the administration is saying that these folks are ineligible. Where does that determination come from? Let's start there.
Sure. So ineligibility is a classification that government lawyers came up with to sort of limit the class size of this lawsuit to which this deadline, this very tough deadline, applies. And so there are a wide range of people who are considered ineligible, some of whom everybody sort of agrees, the ACLU who filed the lawsuit and the government, should not be returned to their children. Those are parents who have very serious criminal records, histories of child endangerment, sexual assault, things of that nature. No one's arguing for those children to be reunited with their parents. But certainly there are a lot of people who are deeply concerned about parents who were deported without their children, sort of, you know, the government's own work, and now have been lost somewhere in Central America. Those people, I think the ACLU would like to see have their children back as soon as possible.
And that just sounds traumatic to me. And you've reported on this for the New York Times that 450 migrant parents we're talking about have been deported without their children.
Roughly, yes. I mean, there's one father in Guatemala who I spoke to last week, for example. He's illiterate. He's a potato farmer. He lives in a small town, and he speaks in the indigenous language. And he says he gets his news from the radio. He hasn't received any word from the United States government. He basically calls a consulate in Los Angeles every 4 days to ask for an update about his daughter. She was 5 when she went into custody, and she's turned 6. And he kept asking me over and over again, how long is it going to be until I see her? And of course, I couldn't give him an answer because there isn't an answer right now.
Now, do we know how many parents may have, quote unquote, self-deported, thinking that if they left the United States, this would make it easier for them to perhaps be reunited with their children?
This is a really tricky question. The government hasn't given us a firm answer as to how many parents signed orders of deportation versus how many were not given a choice. But it's also further complicated by this idea that the ACLU filed a motion actually yesterday saying that a lot of parents who signed and agreed to their deportation are now saying they don't know what they signed because the documents they signed weren't translated into their native languages, or they feel they were manipulated or forced to sign under duress. The father in Guatemala I mentioned told me that he was told by a border agent that he would have his daughter back in 2 weeks if he agreed to go home to Guatemala. It had been 4 weeks when I spoke to him, and he still had no news.
And do we know where his daughter is?
His daughter's in New York, and we know that because we're in touch with lawyers representing her as well. But sometimes even when you know where both parties are, there's very little that can be done.
So we heard at the top of the show Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen talking about her views on how successful this has been so far. And I want to play you an additional clip in which she talks about some of the blame and where that should be placed.
Well, the part, it's up to the parents. So if the parents contact us and they would like to be reunited, we, of course, will work with them. But as you know, the way the process works is the parents always have the choice to take the children with them. So these are parents who have made the decision not to bring the children with them, and then we'll continue to work with the court to understand how we can best comply with the order.
Caitlin, it sounds like she's putting the blame on the parents of these children. Is that accurate?
I think when it comes to the question of why we still see so many kids not reunited, it would be hard to place that blame on the parents since the kids were sort of forcibly taken away. And as far as delays go, I mean, we've heard sort of chaotic scenes playing out across the country where children have been sent to the wrong detention facilities, not where their parents actually are, you know, or sent to detention facilities only to then find out that their parents have actually been deported. And in places like Texas, where a lot of reunifications are happening, people are having to wait hours and even sometimes days, more than a week, to be reunited after they're brought to these facilities because there's such a backup, you know, to try to meet this court deadline. So there's a lot of logistical planning that really falls on the government that's happening at the very last moment, if at all. And I think that's responsible for most of the delays we're seeing now.
And we're also hearing about a lot of chaos happening at Port Isabel, where a lot of these reunifications is supposed to be happening. People put on buses without necessarily having enough food or anything. We're definitely going to be continuing to pay attention to this story. Caitlin Dickerson, immigration reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
When the Trump administration announced its zero tolerance policy, the goal of the policy was to deter migrants from coming to the U.S. illegally.
Hopefully people will get the message and come through the border at the port of entry and not break across the border unlawfully.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking on Fox News back in June. But has this policy actually reduced the number of people migrating to the U.S.? Well, the data shows us that it hasn't. Last May, U.S. Border Patrol apprehended about 14,000 migrants. This past May, U.S. Border Patrol apprehended more than 40,000 migrants. That's almost three times as many. But the situation on the ground is a little more complex.
Yeah, people are not going to stop going to the U.S., you know, unless we have some actual jobs here. I mean, who the hell wants to work for, you know, $6 a day? You know, we need some real jobs.
That's 43-year-old Maurice, and he lived in the United States for most of his life, but was deported back to El Salvador 10 years ago. He spoke with Mexico City-based journalist Emily Green, who recently traveled to El Salvador to report on Central American migration for The Intercept.
What we hear is that people are fleeing violence, and that is absolutely true. But when I was in El Salvador, a lot of what I heard is that people aren't making any money, and they are living in very violent situations. And so I think it's a little bit a mix of the two and perhaps a more nuanced picture than a lot of what we hear in the United States. And that is not to say that there are not cases where it is purely violence and people's lives have been threatened and they think that if they're going to stay or know that if they're going to stay, they will be murdered. But I think for the vast majority of people, it's some confluence of the two.
And when we zone in a little bit on family separation, the stated goal of this policy here in the United States was basically to prevent this migration at all from occurring. And I'm wondering, is the message getting through to people in Central America, particularly the folks that you interviewed in El Salvador?
What I heard in El Salvador from the many people that I interviewed, it is true for many months and a long time, people thought that the best way and the best chance for claiming asylum was to go with their young children. And many people did that. And the message is coming through loud and clear. Trump's family separation policy made front page news for days on end in the major Salvadoran newspapers. And there were pictures of kids in cages, etc. And so it was a big deal. And I did talk to people who said they would absolutely think twice or perhaps not go because they would be scared of being separated from their children. At the same time, various studies have come out, for example, from the Washington Office of Latin America called WOLA, that says Trump's family separation policy has made no difference. It is true that border crossings decreased in June, but that is to be expected. For the last 18 years, we have seen a decrease in border crossings in June because it's simply so hot and it's extremely dangerous to cross the border and the desert when it's so hot. So the statistics are not bearing out any evidence that Trump's family separation policy is making a difference. And I will say, you know, we might have to wait and see. For example, when Trump first took office, border crossings did decline a lot in those first initial months. But then within 12 months of his being in office, they had shot right back up to the Obama-level rates. So just because we see some trend one way or another in the first month, that by no means indicates what the longer-term trend is going to be.
Now, we also know, at least for the past couple of years, my understanding is that migration from Mexico has actually gone down. It's been on the decrease for a couple years now. And there are many different factors that play into that. But it still seems to be counter to the narrative that we keep hearing about all these quote-unquote people coming across the border. Do you suspect that a similar trend could take hold perhaps longer term for migrants from Central America?
I don't think so. I mean, the situation, at least in El Salvador, is quite dire. It is very violent. And just to give you an illustration of that, there are so-called red zones in El Salvador, basically neighborhoods that are off limits. Now, I went to one of those neighborhoods only because I was visiting a church, and churches are somewhat safe ground, especially the evangelical church. And I went with a fixer, which is somebody, basically a Salvadoran reporter who was helping me navigate. And when we entered this neighborhood, he said to me, "Roll down your window," which surprised me because this entire time that I'd been in El Salvador, we had our windows rolled up. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because they want to see your face and they want to make sure that you're not an enemy and that you're not from a rival gang." Now, that just speaks to the degree of lawlessness and insecurity in El Salvador. And at the same level, the economy is really bad. I mean, I talked to so many people who are making less than $10 a day. One woman in particular, her name is Edith, makes $5.50 a day, and she is a live-in housekeeper and nanny. So if you put those together, the economy and the violence, I don't think that we're going to see a decrease in migration from the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala anytime soon.
And you mentioned Edith Tovar Rodriguez, and she had some pretty powerful stuff to say.
Sometimes the pastor says, "Edith, you tried twice already, and if God didn't give you the opportunity to go, it's because he doesn't want you there." But then I look at the reality here, the unemployment, the lack of freedom because of the gangs. When I look at what's happening in El Salvador, I feel motivated to try again.
Edith is a very religious woman. She has one free day a week, and she spends that entire day at church. So in some ways, she's sort of saying, "I'm defying the will of God." And that just speaks to the desperation that people feel. She feels like if she stays, she has zero future.
Emily Green is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Emily, thanks so much for talking with me about this.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you.